You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Tuesday, 28 July, I'm Simon Brown, coming you live and loud from Houghton, Johannesburg. On the show today, Chantal Marks, FNB Wealth and Investments. We're going to be talking IMF loans. Brian Pinnock from Mindcast, corporate cybersecurity and the responsibility of C-suite execs. And then Tim Akinyusi from Mortgage Market, the home loan market under pandemic. How's the loans going? Are banks lending? The show is proudly sponsored by FMI, a division of Bidvest Life Limited. Make your impact, protect your income first. The views and opinions expressed in this show do not reflect the views and opinions of FMI. Some morning headlines from MoneyWeb: Steinhoff's $19 billion settlement plan gets first endorsement, and Business Day, first for SA as IMF approves a $70 billion COVID-19 loan. Morning markets green in the US, S&P up 0.7, NASDAQ up 1.7. Asia, we've got Sydney up 0.2 and Tokyo flat. Commodities, PGMs are red, gold 1938. Off the highs, it was above 1970 earlier overnight, and oil slightly green. Rand 1642. Top 40 opening call looking for about 0.5% green.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting with Chantal Marks. She's head of research, FNB Wealth and Investments. Chantal, appreciate your time. Let's quickly touch on IMF. Announced last night, we're getting, $4.3 billion. It's just over 70 billion ZAR. Should be here within the next week or two, arriving in the country. 70 billion, that's a big weekend, unless, of course, you're a government, in which case it's about half of our annual interest payment. It's fairly modest, useful, but not going to be a game changer, or am I being a little over simplistic?
Well, you're not being overly simplistic, and you're not being overly negative if you look at Twitter. And people are already thinking that this loan will mean absolutely nothing in the hands of government. But I'm a little bit more optimistic. I think that it's a welcome relief. It plugs quite a substantial hole in terms of the budget shortfall that was forecasted by the minister in his latest emergency budget. And importantly, it's cheap financing. So it's financing that government did not have to put on itself. So it wasn't raised in the bond market. And they'll get favorable interest rates, as far as I understand. I don't know what the exact interest rate will be, but it'll be decent. So borrowing, the cost of borrowing that 70 billion rand is a little bit lower than what they would have gotten if they went to buy it themselves.
Yeah, I couldn't find the confirmation of the interest rate, but I'm seeing speculation. It could be as low as 1%, and we're typically borrowing at closer to 8 or 9, so that certainly is a good deal. Let's bring it back home. Steinhoff, a stock which has really been off most people's radars, but they're settling the legal claims. It's a long process. It's got a lot of people who need to give it approval. Part of it's going to be with Pepco shares. Of course, those Pepco shares are now down from what the value they're using. But if they can get this out of the way, it kind of draws a line under the fraud and kind of lets them move on, because otherwise these claims could literally run on for years, if not a decade, in court cases.
Absolutely. And these claims are massive. By the company's own estimate, it now stands at 136 billion rand. This company does not have a positive, tangible net asset value. It has loads of debt. And this just is a cost that keeps on dragging and dragging and dragging. They've got contingent liabilities, what they call contingent liabilities, on their balance sheet, which just muddies the waters. So they're trying to settle with shareholders, and it's shareholders who bought Steinhoff shares in the market, as well as the poor guys who actually sold their businesses to Steinhoff and received Steinhoff shares instead of cash. So looking to at least return something to them, I've calculated back of a matchbox about 12 and 20 per 100 rand invested, so that's 12.2 cents on the rand. So you're not getting everything back. But given the state of the finances of this company currently, I think it actually looks like a pretty good deal. The shareholders, who actually should be getting nothing.
Yeah, Yeah, I got to say.
Think about it.
Yeah, and 12.2 cents per that's actually not bad, I think. And better than I think many people would have thought in that horrible December morning when the news broke. Invicta results site yesterday. This was once the darling of our market. I'm looking at a chart that shows me a 130 Rand share price back in 2013. And in part, they've been, you know, an economy that really hasn't helped them and their business. What did you make of the results? And what stood out for me was, you know, write-downs exceeding market capitalization. Well, I suppose that probably says more about the share price perhaps than it does about the balance sheet.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the share price has been under extreme pressure. But I mean, there was at one point also talks of a rights offer. They said to the market that they were going to sell quite a bit of assets. They did end up making an announcement to that effect. They're going to sell about, I think they're getting a selling price of about 609 million for some of the assets in a business called Capital Equipment Group. Mm-hmm. And that should help the balance sheet a little bit. What stood out to me was actually that it didn't look too bad if you stop looking at, if you don't look at the impairment, if you kind of just ignore the impairment. Headline earnings per share was down 48%, but borrowing costs was up quite a bit. So operationally speaking, in a very poor environment where every possible cycle is against them, I think it was okay. And it does tell me that this company does have a future. It just needs a little bit of a cleaning up and a little bit of support from the economy around it. And it needs to lighten that debt load, which it is trying to do at the moment.
And that's actually a great point. I mean, we look at the results, we look at impairments, we look at debt. What you're saying is we need to actually look through this because, you know, some of the debt's going to come down with that 600 million from the sale. That'll help the business. Impairments, all things equal, are a one-off and a historic thing. Investing's really about trying to say the future, the next year, three, five, you know, what is the earning potential? And notwithstanding some headwinds, Invicta has an earnings potential out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very difficult to right now in the middle of COVID-19 and the largest recession that we're probably ever going to see in our lifetime to say that a company like this has a bright future. But the world does go back to normal eventually, or well, that's my premise anyway. Mm-hmm. And when it does, there will be support for companies that sell bearings and other equipment into the manufacturing and construction and mining space. It won't just disappear. So on that premise, there is a bit of a future, but that being said, there could still be a little bit of pain to come near term.
There certainly could be some pain, but the company will survive. Chantal Marx, Head of Research at FNB Wealth and Investments, always appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
Chatting now with Brian Pinnock. He's a cyber security expert at Mimecast. Brian, appreciate your time. Two stories making news at the moment. One is my Garmin watch is not updating, and I don't know if it doesn't tell me I slept or did I sleep. They apparently hit by ransomware. And then, of course, there was the biggest story I was reading in the weekend. Norsk Hydro also hit by ransomware. What is ransomware? I mean, am I right where this is basically where your computer networks are locked down until you make a payment, i.e. a ransom, to get them unlocked?
Yes, good morning. That's exactly correct. Ransomware is where cyber threat actors somehow find their way into your organization. There's a number of ways they can get in, primarily via email and web, but there are a number of other ways they can do that. What they do is they then actually spend quite a long time working what we call lateral movement, in other words, spreading, a little bit like the coronavirus, in fact, if you think about it, spreading quietly, sort of without any sort of form of indication that they're there. And only once they've managed to infect a large number of machines, and what they hope, and you hope not, is your backups as well, is they will then execute the encryption, which means basically they render all of your data useless, and then they'll issue the ransom. And it's usually paid in some form of cryptocurrency or asked to be paid in some form of cryptocurrency.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, in Norsk Hydro's story, the ransomers were in that system literally for months, getting to every corner to infiltrate. And as you say, the backups. I want to come to backups in a moment. I mean, the risk is here. I imagine a lot of it's going to be sort of social engineering, getting me to click on a link that I shouldn't. Those risks must be heightened with a work from home. If I'm at my corporate headquarters, I'm probably behind a firewall, etc. As soon as I'm at home, the risks are increasing.
You are 100% right. We've actually got some hard evidence to back that up. What we found, we did a report recently, the Mimecast 100 Days of COVID. And what we saw was, if you look back, a number of months before COVID, we saw the sort of normal ups and downs, but the lines are fairly flat in terms of organizations. What was interesting, actually, two things. One was that organizations that used cyber awareness training were five times less likely to have employees who clicked on malicious links. But even the ones who did have cyber awareness training, what we found is as COVID sort of started to bite down and the lockdown started to get more restrictive, and this is a global thing, we sort of saw it in waves in different countries, but it almost mapped perfectly to the lockdowns in those countries, is we saw this increase in susceptibility, I guess you could use, for users to click on links. Now, we're not 100% sure what the cause of those are. We're only seeing the effect. That could be people's spouse or sort of school-going children using their devices. But whatever the cause is, it's definitely the case that people at home, working from home, are a lot less secure than they were. Organizations are not sort of taking that risk and integrating that into their plans properly.
You mentioned backups. I mean, backups can, I do backups all over the place into the cloud, etc. But I mean, this can also be corrupted. So you can do staff training and tell them not to click on links. You can back up systems, but it's almost a sense. I mean, can you get a system that is, in a sense, immune to being hijacked?
So no system is entirely immune to being hijacked. What you can do is create a cyber resilience strategy. In fact, the World Economic Forum has actually got a really good set of toolkits that you can download straight off their website. And I would start with the board level kind of toolkits, which talk about the principles of cyber resilience. And from there, you can actually go to things like get right down, because those are sort of at the high level strategic and sort of business level. And then you can get down to the tactical level about what you actually do. Backups are a key part of protecting yourself against ransomware, but they're literally your kind of last defense against ransomware. Ideally, you should be in a situation where ransomware doesn't spread at all. If you look, and Garmin's not saying much, so what we're doing is we're relying on media reports and what look like leaks, which again is a problem. From Garmin themselves, their employees are taking screenshots and sending them out on social media and things and getting it to the media. And this is sort of massively problematic, but it certainly looks like Garmin, and I can't say for sure, but didn't have some of the sort of fairly basic cybersecurity kind of principles in place. And I think those are kind of an absolute must.
That's a great point. I mean, should not companies, particularly large corporates, particularly listed companies, but any sort of decent-sized company, I mean, should they have in their C-suite a chief security officer, someone whose sole job is cybersecurity?
We certainly believe so, and certainly at board level, even if you don't have a CISO sitting on your board, you should certainly have an accountable officer. So first of all, one of the key principles is everyone on the board is actually responsible. So the total board is responsible for cyber resilience. Second of all, they should have some command of the subject. A lot of boards kind of delegate that down to the sort of IT person or even worse, if it's a sort of chief financial officer and the IT person is, reporting into them, that then gets delegated completely off the board. And lastly, I agree, you should have some sort of an accountable officer, even if it's not the chief security officer, and that's ideal. Things like banks and large financial institutions tend to have a CISO on the board, but certainly an individual who's accountable, but the overall board is accountable as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. We'll leave that there. Brian Pinnock, he's Mimecast cyber security expert. Appreciate your time this morning. When you protect your monthly income against the risk of injury, illness and death, you protect your future and the impact you make on those around you. FMI has been protecting South Africans' income for over 25 years, constantly innovating to provide greater claim certainty and cover for more occupations than ever before. Make your impact, protect your income first. FMI, life done better. FMI, a division of Bidvest Life, is a licensed life insurer and authorized financial services provider.
MoneyWeb now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Tim Akinski, founder of Mortgage Market. Tim, appreciate your time this morning. I want to touch on mortgages. Before we get to that, broadly, house prices during the pandemic in South Africa, are we getting any data out yet which tells us whether prices are under pressure, whether they're holding? I can't believe they'll be going up, but is there any data coming through yet?
Hi, good morning, Simon. There's some early indications that there is some pressure around house prices, but it's at a category level. So if you look at high-value homes between call it 2.5-3 million all the way to 10 million, mm-hmm. those prices are under enormous pressure because, you know, the reality is that people are looking for homes that have a lot of economic value. And a lot of the times, high-end homes tend to actually be very price elastic and don't do well in a recessionary time. The area of the segment of the market that is holding quite strongly is the affordable to middle markets because the demand is just so strong there. And we've seen that demand play itself out in the past couple of weeks, given that we are in the level three period and people are looking to take advantage of the low interest rate environment. So there's a lot of demand there. Those homes are quite resilient. That market between 750 to 1.5 million, very, very resilient.
That's a good, I mean, actually, I have two friends who have bought houses during lockdown. I mean, you know, hats off to them. And you're obviously in the mortgage space. So you know, if there's demand down in that low end, I imagine we're seeing applications picking up. And are banks lending? Are banks happy to lend, obviously, you know, to the right credit risk, to the right evaluations?
Absolutely. Simon, it's been unbelievably positive, you know, and that V-shaped recovery that has been playing out throughout level three. Obviously, in the months of April and the first week of May were completely muted, but we've seen close to 30% year-on-year growth in intake volumes. So for us, you know, we've seen a number of pre-approvals, which is the first indication that a customer is keen to look at buying property. They want to find out exactly how much they can afford mm-hmm. and how much the bank is willing to lend to them. We've seen such a large intake of consumers looking at trying to find a pre-approval. So what this has meant is that we're going to see a surge for the next couple of months, and it's unfortunate that the surge is not really going to materialize in a real way, given that COVID-19 is still impacting the capacity at the deeds office. So as a result of that, you know, the flow through to registrations and real income through to banks, estate agents, and originators like ourselves is still very muted. But I think that there's a positive case we made for future growth, given what the pipeline is.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. There's an entire process and a number of different parts of that process, one of them the deeds office, and that can certainly be holding it up. Banks are lending. Are we back in the days, you know, 100% loans, or are they sort of wanting deposits, 10-15% deposits? Low interest rates certainly taking pressure off consumers to a degree.
Yes, you're right. Banks are lending, and what has been impressive is to just see how they've been skillfully advanced in home loans without being reckless at all. There's been a lot of lessons learned from the global financial crisis of 08-09. So even when banks do lend at 100%, and in some cases they lend over 100%, call it 105%, obviously to include the cost mm-hmm. of transfer duties and registration costs, they are lending into the right categories. So they're lending to first-time home buyers. They're lending into the smaller loan sizes that's under 1.5 million. So it's the right type of lending. So if we look at the larger categories, there's still an expectation for consumers to put down a deposit and have some skin in the game. And rightfully so, because as I mentioned earlier, the demand and the price resilience of these high-end homes is weak and has been weak for some time.
Yeah, and of course, the lower interest rates, and we are at, you know, prime at 7% is sort of generational lows. That certainly increases affordability, and apparently we're seeing some activity, which is good news for an economy and good news for people generally. That's Tim Akinyuski. He's founder, Mortgage Market. Appreciate your time. That's it for today. You'll find us live every weekday morning at 6:30. You find us on MoneyWeb website or the MoneyWeb app. And then, of course, podcast from 7 a.m. wherever good podcasts are aggregated. Chat to us on the social media, Twitter, Facebook, hashtag MoneyWeb now. This show was proudly sponsored by FMI, a division of Bidvest Life Limited. Make your impact, protect your income first. The views and opinions expressed in this show do not reflect the views and opinions of FMI. A massive thanks to my team, Eddie and Cordora, to you for listening, my guests for the early morning time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.